Try to picture this scene, if you will. It's in the upper room. Jesus has already washed the feet of his followers. And they're in the midst of dinner, supper, toward the end. And he comes out with this horrific announcement. He looks up. There's stunned silence in the room. He looks around and he says, "One of you will betray me." And moments later, as we know, Judas walks out the door after Jesus has dipped the last piece of bread in the wine and given it to him. It's at that point that Jesus tells them he's going to leave them, and that where he's going, they cannot come. And Peter being Peter, he says, "Lord, why can't I follow you? Lord, you know that I will lay down my life for you." Jesus turns to him and says, "Peter, later this very night, you too will betray me." Now, wedged in between these two events, you can look at them as bookends, if you will. This Judas, this event of Judas and the betrayal, and Peter getting this warning from Jesus. John plops this message from Jesus right smack in the middle. He gives his friends a new commandment, and the commandment is, "You are to love one another as I have loved you." So what we have here clearly is a message of love that seems to have little or nothing to do with the before and the after. This message of love is bracketed by acts of betrayal. Not only acts of betrayal, but acts committed by two of his very closest friends and companions. Now, I suspect, I don't know for sure, but I suspect just about everyone in this room has had one experience or another of, let's call it, betrayal. I mean, at one end of the spectrum is, you can figure this one out for yourself. Our daughter in Fredericksburg, you know, she tries to get these two wild kids in order, and the little girl's pretty much there, but the little boy, Andrew, 6, the little guy has, and I'm sure this is not my side of the family, by the way, but the little guy, no matter what it is, puts his little feet, you know, into the cement, and he's not going to do whatever. And there's no rhyme or reason to it. And he comes out sometimes and says something very hurtful to Kathleen, our daughter. And you can just see the poor woman, my daughter, and she is a woman, stinging from the remark. Almost a mark of betrayal, you know, of someone she loves so dearly. But on the other, moving along the spectrum, maybe it's just somebody, you know, that makes a promise to you. And for one reason or another, perhaps no reason, breaks the promise or ignores the promise, never follows through. And then over here, at the other end of the, far end of the spectrum, maybe you've, someplace where you work, there's a friend, someone you've worked with, a coworker, maybe somebody you worked with, someone you worked for, or someone who works for you, has suddenly turned against you for some reason, unfathomable. Some years ago, I worked in the federal government, and I hired a young man who was going to be a writer. He applied to be a writer in our department. The odds were stacked against him. I had received a recommendation from another colleague at work to look at this guy. He was not a federal employee, which those of you who are in the federal government know it's pretty next to impossible to break in. He wasn't employed anywhere. And he was a college dropout to boot. He made it, I think, through half of the first year at the University of Houston. So I knew he was a big risk. Long story short, I decided to take a chance, and I hired him. And it turned out, thank God, he was everything and a lot more than I had hoped for. He was a great writer, very gifted guy, intelligent guy, and he worked very hard, did whatever was asked of him. But later, toward the end of his first year, something else kind of came out and surfaced about him that I didn't know. It turns out he was an ambitious young man. Nothing wrong with ambition, except on this particular occasion, I was on a temporary assignment in Memphis. And some friends of mine back at headquarters called me up and said, "Hey, Bob, this guy's doing a number on you. He's put together a plan to take over your job before you get back from your assignment. Not only that, according to his plan, you're going to take his job, he's going to take your job. You might want to do something about it." That night, I was on a plane. I came back to Washington, and I met with a friend who was a little farther up the federal food chain, and told him about it, asked his advice, and was told one line, "Put it out of your mind, don't worry about it." Before the end of the day, the whole matter had just kind of evaporated into thin air, and I caught the next plane back. It was almost like it never happened after that. What was fascinating was I wasn't angry toward him, but this sting of betrayal wormed its way into my soul. And I remember being left with this deep sense of sorrow and grief that someone I had mentored, I not only hired him, I mentored him and shepherded him through the minefields at headquarters, and he became a great friend, a dear friend, like brothers almost. It was uncanny. And the fact that he would do me harm was just more than I could fathom, to tell you the truth. I can only imagine the grief and sorrow that Jesus must have experienced that night, knowing that two of his closest friends were about to betray him. Barbara Brown Taylor, an Episcopal priest I often quote, as you know, has this to say about that situation for Jesus. She says, "To be abandoned by those who are closest to him, to be stabbed from behind by those who know him best. This," she says, "is as wounding as the fat nails that finally pin him to the cross." Great stuff, as only she can write. And what does Jesus do? He loves them. He loves them. He loves them just as they are. Betrayals and all. Mother warts. There's a word for it. It's called sacrificial love. Two words. In Jesus' case, it's an act of love, freely given, not forced on him. Jesus knowingly will lay down his life for his friends and followers, and that includes those who will betray him, by the way. Now, for some of us, myself, I'm speaking for mostly, I also find that kind of love, sorry, a little irritating. It's irritating for me because it eats away at my sense of fairness. I don't know where that comes from. It grates against my natural inclination to get angry, and if not angry, or just as well to get even when someone betrays our trust. And yet Jesus would have us love these people. And that can be downright irritating at times, at least for me. Now, I know you're all saints of God. That doesn't apply to you. But for me, often we have, and Maud will bear this out, we have people come to the door during the week asking for money. Lots of money sometimes, hundreds of dollars. And they come out with, and on rare occasions, it falls to me to meet with them, and they begin to unravel this bizarre story that I know isn't true. Mainly because coming from New Jersey, I know a con when I see one. But that aside, as Maud put it to me one time, C finds it helpful to try to get into their skin and to see what their lives are like, and then to she can understand better why they fabricate stories to make their living this way. It's still tough for me, and I cave in. Not to the tune of several hundred bucks, but I cave in to something. And it's tough for me to remember that Jesus wants me to love these people, to be honest with you. It's constant work for me. And yet that's precisely what Jesus tells his followers. He says, forget what other people are going to say to you. Forget what they think about you. Or for that matter, forget what they're going to do to you or even persecute you, lie to you, seek to do you harm. None of that matters. Two things matter. Love and compassion. That's it. And you know why that is? It's because he's teaching them that love and compassion have this extraordinary, amazing, overwhelming power to cast out evil in all its forms, including our hatred, our anger, our cynicism, whatever else clouds our ability to love. A couple of weeks ago, that Muslim couple, I know you've heard this mentioned, that they came to speak to us at our scholars program. And I watched them as they talked about how they were brought up, and all Muslims are brought up from little time they're little children to adulthood and beyond, to realize that God is in the midst of their everyday lives. That includes not only animate other people, but inanimate objects. She talked about the rocks on the ground, you know, the sand. God is present in all of this. And she said, the husband made the point that God created us to be like God. And we say it's also to be like Jesus. To love others as and love ourselves. But to love as Jesus has loved us. But I know something else about this couple that I found fascinating. As I sat there watching them, I noticed there was something loving and peaceful about these two people. You could hear it in their words, the words they chose to explain their faith, and how they expressed those words. It was written all over their faces and their entire demeanor, how they exchanged glances to one another, unspoken, you know, cues to with each other. Do you want to add anything to that? You know, you could see it. And you could see, not only did they love each other, but they both exuded this peacefulness. And I'll tell you something else that occurred to me that night. I actually found myself wanting to be just like them when I grow up. I too, not to be a Muslim, but I too found myself wanting to be more loving and peaceful just listening to this couple. And I start thinking right then and there, maybe it's something I should be working on here. Later in the week, something occurred to me. The more I thought about it, the more I began to realize that this change, this ability to love, doesn't start with me. It starts with God. And the reason is simple. It's because the very essence of God is love, as we all know. Now, I got to tell you, I got a theory about that too. I think that God's love has a way of sneaking up on us. Now, yeah, it probably has a lot to do with, you know, us mellowing as we age and time passes and wounds begin to heal. But I think that happens by an act of God, whereby God's love creeps its way into our souls and heals our wounds and our past grievances kind of turn to dust, you know. I think I have to cave in to love when it comes. Truth be told, I never did hold a grudge against my friend. Maybe it's because our friendship was so powerful to start with the beginning. We never even spoke about it. There was never an apology. It's like it never happened. We both kind of recognized from one another that it probably should have never happened in the first place. But for me, the sting of betrayal was real, and it was painful, just wrenching. And so I remember it to this day, but I also know it's past. And I'll tell you something else. I find myself wanting to see him again. And I haven't seen him in, I don't know, 6, 7 years now. I would love to see him again. Maybe that's God infusing me with this love that's sneaking up on me. I don't know, but I do know it's God's doing. I remember reading somewhere that Jesus loved Judas. He knew what Judas was up to. He knew what he was going to do later that night. And yet, he washed his feet. He fed him from his own hands. And he even still loved Jesus later that night when Jesus came up to him and kissed him as a sign, a signal of his betrayal in the Garden of Gethsemane. That kind of love never dies. The Jews have a word for it called hesed. It means steadfast love. And that extends to us as well. And it's also why Jesus invites us to this table to feed us. And we're all invited to come to be fed, to be loved, just as we are. Warts and all. Amen. In the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.